Now, Deep Impact might have been a bit of a boring film, but the best bits were definitely when the spacecraft landed on the asteroid with the intention of coming back. Well, now, that's about to happen in real life, except without the threat of global annihilation, which is nice. Joining us to discuss these and other stories is Ben Lewis, producer and editor for Australia's Science Channel. Welcome, Ben.
Hello.
Hello. Good to see you again. I understand you've just had a lovely holiday and you're refreshed and restored.
Yes. Yeah. It shot off to the Maldives for my honeymoon, actually. And, it was as good as everyone says. It's, a bit of a shock coming back to the freezing mornings that we've got at the moment.
Oh, a bit of a shock. That's so fascinating. I'm actually going to Fiji next week for my honeymoon. So, goodbye cold Adelaide and... hello, Tropical Island. But anyway, what can you tell us about the Japanese spacecraft Hayabusa? I think I'm saying that right, too, and what it's chasing.
If you're really looking for, exciting, interesting, and slightly weird space missions, really like the Japanese Space Agency, they're called JAXA. They're the ones you really kind of want to look at because they do some incredible stuff. They don't really get the fame or, the attention that NASA or the European Space Agency get, but they do really, really cool things. So, yeah, Hayabusa 2, which is their current mission or one of the current missions they're working on, they've sent this spaceship and it's about the size of a fridge, essentially. And they've shot it off towards an asteroid called, I'm going to mess this up, I know, but Ryugu. And it's an asteroid about a kilometre in size. At the moment... The spaceship has just caught up to the asteroid. It's about 20 kilometres away from it. Oh. You might go, 20 kilometres sounds like a long way, but it's travelled about 2 billion kilometres to get there. So it's quite a long sort of journey.
It's like a nanometre in space terms.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically right next to it. Over the next 3 months, this spacecraft, Hayabusa 2, is going to be just observing the asteroid and taking all sorts of measurements off it. But what's really, really exciting about this is in a few months' time, the spacecraft is actually going to come down and land on the asteroid, pick up some samples of it, and then bring it all back to Earth. So soon, we're going to actually have pieces of asteroid that have been brought back from the very, very depths of space. And we're going to be able to hold those in our hands. I reckon that's pretty amazing.
That is amazing. So how will the spacecraft actually bring it back? Does it have its own little hands that extend out and sort of pick it up?
So there's a few different pieces of equipment on this spacecraft. First of all, as I said, it's about 20 kilometres away. It's going to be hanging out a little bit away from it for the next 3 months, sort of scanning the asteroid and doing some, measurements of its chemistry and things like that from a bit of a distance. And then it goes close in. It's got four very, very small landers on it. So, little kind of rovers. And they're going to be dispatched. They're going to land on us. And they've got their own sort of scientific equipment. And they're going to be looking at the chemistry of it, what this asteroid is actually made of, how old this asteroid is, which is quite interesting. But, yeah, then when the big spacecraft comes down, Hayabusa 2 itself, it comes down. And what it's actually got is essentially a really big hammer. And that hammer is going to slam into the surface of the asteroid. And that... is kind of going to fling lots of, bits of rock, essentially, and whatever else the asteroid might contain. It's going to fling it up. And as all that debris sort of gets flung up, the spacecraft is going to capture all of it. So the reason for using the hammer there's a couple of reasons. First of all, it makes collection of the bits easier because all of a sudden you get all these small chunks that are sort of flying around that you can just sort of easily grab and hold onto and capture. But also, it's going to break through the very, very top surface of the asteroid. So we're actually going to be able to see what's under the surface. Mm-hmm. So that's really cool. We're going to get some bits of asteroid from the surface of it, and that's sort of been baked by, the sun for however old it is, potentially billions of years. And you're going to see, we're going to get bits of rock from underneath the surface that have never been exposed before. They've never been, dried out by the sun. They've never been affected by any radiation. It's going to be, really, really untouched pieces of asteroid. And that's going to tell us just so much about the history of the solar system and, you know, how we came to be.
Well, here's hoping the blob isn't in there, you know, in the middle. But, you know, what sort of things can we learn by testing what asteroids are made of?
Well, yeah, what's really interesting about Rugu is that it's what's called a Type C asteroid. Now, most asteroids are these sort of Type C, but what we think they're made of is essentially rock from the very, very start of the solar system. So when the solar system and the planets were first starting to form about, 8 billion years ago or so, or 5 to 8 billion years ago, or is it even longer? Gosh, I've had a complete brain fade about how old the solar system is. So right from the very, very start of the solar system, so we're going to learn, you know, how the solar system sort of looked, what was the solar system made of right back then. But what's really exciting is that when we've looked at these sort of asteroids before, they've got all sorts of chemicals in them, and generally they're hydrated, which means they have water with them as well. Mm-hmm. And what they think is that asteroids, just like Rugu, are the asteroids that sort of hold and carry around the very, very building blocks of life itself. Mm-hmm. So the very, very, you know, basic chemicals that you and I are made of, that our DNA is made of, that might be on board this asteroid. They think that basically these asteroids carry these chemicals around the solar system, and one day, many billions of years ago, one or probably many of these asteroids hit Earth, and that's where the very chemicals that started life came from. So if you can find these chemicals on Rugu, it's really just giving us an idea of how we came into existence.
That really is fascinating, and quite a substantive claim to fame for the Japanese Space Agency. What did you say their name was? I've already forgotten, but I feel like we shouldn't.
So the Japanese Space Agency, they go by the name of JAXA, which is
kind of
really
sounds
cool,
a bit like NASA, but just doesn't quite have that name recognition yet.
Yeah, it doesn't quite have the name recognition. It kind of sounds like NASA, but it's got an X in it for, you know, extreme or something.
Yeah,
I'm not quite sure. Exploration, I think they've just put an X in there because it sort of fits.
Extraterrestrial.
Maybe.
Possibly. So, this sounds like it has some very exciting implications for the future extraterrestrial studies. Now, I'm with Ben Lewis from Australia's Science Channel, talking about the latest in research in the science world. Now it's time to talk about cats. And, you know, I quite like cats since I got two of my own. I wasn't really much of a cat person before that. So I was quite sad to hear that cats are actually responsible for killing about 650 million reptiles in Australia every year, according to research published in the Wildlife Research Journal. Ben, how did they calculate this unsettling data?
Yeah, it's a heck of a stat, isn't it? 650 million reptiles every year being killed by cats. So how they came to this number is they combined the data from a whole bunch of other previous studies, so almost 100 studies which have looked at, you know, the cat poo, for example, and looked at what's in cat poo, and whenever they've caught feral cats as well, and sort of looked at what's inside the stomachs of feral cats. So they've combined all this data, and they've ended up with around about 10,000 cats that have been studied in all those studies. And then from that, from those 10,000 cats and how much or how many reptiles they have eaten, they've sort of extrapolated that out and said, well, there's between two and 6 million cats in Australia. If we take what we know about, you know, these 10,000 cats, extrapolate that out, it probably means that cats in Australia are eating around about 650 million reptiles a year. Now, it's worth pointing out that by far the majority of those reptiles are being eaten by feral cats. So these aren't necessarily your pets. It's the feral cats out in the bush. And we know that these are really, really destructive to wildlife and to the ecosystem. We really, really need to do some, you know, you know, concerted efforts to control feral cat numbers. And this is just extra evidence towards that.
So what sort of reptiles are we talking about? Because, you know, I don't really mind if they're knocking off a few brown snakes. but there are a few endangered ones as well being affected, I imagine.
Yeah, they've sort of found that the cats seem to prefer or seem to you know, eat around about 250 particular species. There's about 1,000 species of reptiles in Australia. Cats were found to sort of, you know, only eat about 250 of those. But of those 250, 11 are endangered. So 11 are really threatened when it comes to their numbers. So that's a really big concern. But like you said, it's probably not, you know, it's not your brown snakes or probably not your brown snakes. It's more, you know, small lizards and skinks and even some turtles. They found some turtles had been eaten as well. So it's sort of like a broad range, but it's generally, you know, towards a smaller end of the scale, which makes sense when you look at a cat and they're not that big. Yeah, so on average, a feral cat was found to be eating around about 225 reptiles a year, so almost one a day. Having said that, one particular cat that they studied was found to have 40 lizards in its stomach.
Oh my goodness!
At once, so it had it gone down to the, you know, the feral cat sizzler or something like that. You know, it hit the buffet. But you know, so. Really, you know, super, super destructive. Most of it's happening out in the bush where, you know, all the feral cats live, but also a lot of these endangered reptiles live. Your pet cat isn't off the hook, though. They eat somewhere, you know, on average around about 14 reptiles every year. Now, chances are, because they're living in the suburbia, in the suburbs, they're not going to be endangered reptiles. We don't really have those in, you know, in the city. But, you know, there's still, you know, that sort of like wildlife and ecosystem destruction. And we need to, you know, sort of think about what we can do to protect reptiles and also birds and our native species from, you know, the actions of cats.
I certainly get a lot of rodent gifts. So I wouldn't be surprised if they were getting a few others as well. But as you say, it's mostly feral cats. So what are some of the potential solutions to this? Do we need more adoption or desexing or even hunting? What can we do?
So a lot of the control you know, methods so far for feral cats has sort of looked at trapping and hunting and trying to remove them from the, you know, remove them from the ecosystem. You know, desexing of your own cat and you know, desexing of pets and making sure that pets don't get loose because they sort of go off to become feral cats or can become feral cats. That's one particular, you know, one thing that we need to do. But yeah, there's a lot of, you know, baiting sort of strategies and hunting and trapping that sort of happen out in the bush to try to keep these numbers under control. You know, really, humans, we've made a bit of a mess of Australia, it has to be said. You know, we've released feral cats into the outback. There's rabbits as well. You know, there's wild pigs up in north, you know, in Queensland as well. So, yeah, we're kind of at the moment trying to undo our own actions from 150, 200 years ago because we're starting to realize, hey, you know, these are actually having a really big impact. 650 million reptiles a year. It's starting to make a little bit of
a
dent.
It's a big number. Let's hope we can fix it without bringing in any new species. So on to something else now. We drink a lot of coffee in this country. It seems like there's always some kind of new fancy thing on offer as baristas try to outdo each other to get our attention. But, Ben, I never thought it would come to this. Broccoli lattes have hit some very cool cafes in Melbourne. What can you tell us about these?
Yeah, if you're sitting there in a cafe at the moment sipping your turmeric latte, you've been usurped, you know. You're not on trend anymore.
Oh, dear.
It's all about the broccoli latte. So the CSIRO have been working for a little while to try to work out what we can do to increase the number of vegetables that people eat. And they've come up with a way that they can make broccoli powder. And this is like super concentrated broccoli in a powder. And then they've given it to a whole bunch of people around Australia to say, you know, see what you can make with this. And one cafe put their hand up and went, you know what, we're going to make broccoli lattes. And I think it's fair to say the reaction to that has been mixed.
Right.
Yeah, so some people said it was quite good. Some people hated it with a passion. Even the barista who made it himself, he said, look, I love, you know, if you love broccoli, you'll love this. If you don't like broccoli, you probably won't. I love broccoli and I found it palatable.
I see.
Palatable. Not good, palatable. Just palatable.
You can drink it if your life depends on it.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the reactions to broccoli lattes are sort of mixed. But, yeah, the CSIRO with this powder is really, you know, 51% of us don't eat enough, you know, vegetables every single day. And, you know, so half of us aren't eating enough vegetables in our life. And that's actually a really, you know, surprising and sort of scary stat. We can do a lot to improve our diets. So the CSIRO are trying to, you know, look at broccoli and carrots and different vegetables. What can they do to sort of, you know, produce them in different forms so that we can use these vegetables and eat these vegetables
in different ways. Make it more accessible to hipsters. Does it provide the same nutritional value as regular broccoli, this powder?
Absolutely. It 100% does. So all the nutrients from your broccoli are in the powder. And in fact, one serve of broccoli is the equivalent of 2 tablespoons of powder. So you don't actually really need to eat that much powder in order to have one serve of vegetables. And considering we're meant to eat, you know, five serves of vegetables a day, you know, maybe a broccoli latte, all of a sudden that's one of your serves of vegetables. You've hit one on the head already. Mm. But, you know, before you've even, you know, you've hit one on the head by morning tea time. So, it's potentially a really, really powerful way of making sure and, you know, boosting the number of vegetables we have and that we eat. But the flip side of it is not only to, as I said, make sure that we're actually eating enough, it's to make better use of what we're growing as well. Around about 10 to 20% of broccoli crops are sort of just sent to waste. They're either ploughed back into the fields or they're not sold and they're sort of sent to waste because they're not sold, and that might be because they're, you know, a little bit ugly or disfigured. So this is what the CSIRO are actually taking to use make their broccoli powder. They're taking all those sort of, you know, discarded broccoli, the stems, the leaves, the stuff that gets left in the field and not harvested, the ugly stuff that we tend not to buy for whatever reason, even though it's fine. So they're actually reducing food waste and at the same time increasing the amount of vegetables we eat. It's really a win-win for everyone.
And is this like something that can be applied to other vegetables? I didn't even know the powdering of vegetables was a thing, but are we going to have carrot lattes, Brussels sprout lattes?
Yeah, they really, really think that it could be done with pretty much any vegetable. They have worked on a carrot one, and I think they said that was, you know, fairly successful in terms of turning it into a powder. Basically, it's a quite complicated process of a few different treatments and like dehydration and drying it out and then crushing it up and sort of going through this quite complex process. But they have said that, yeah, we can pretty much do this with, you know, most, if not all, vegetables. It's really, you know, they just need to try it out, see what it comes up with, and then, you know, find uses for it as well. It's not only the lattes, they are talking about, you know, putting it into pasta, for example, or making even snacks and like potato chips essentially out of it. So, yeah, it really is, you know, your vegetables now might be in a completely different form in the future.
Well, it's an exciting time to be alive for lovers of vegetable powder and coffee. I think I'd have to have mine dirty because you can't take away the caffeine. But Ben Lewis, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's been a pleasure going over these topics.
It's been fun as always.